All right. So with Daniel, we've kind of seen the journey that's been taken with this. And, you know, we see the interactions that Daniel and King Nebuchadnezzar has been having. And right now we're getting ready to see the fall and the rise of Nebuchadnezzar. And it's often said that truth is stranger than fiction. And Daniel chapter 4 is a good example of that. With that, you know, it's like a weird episode. It's actually one of the weirdest episodes in all of the Bible. It's like a State of the Union message from King Nebuchadnezzar to all the people under his authority or his domain. And with that also, if you're not sure, the State of the Union, it's an American tradition that goes back to the Constitution, where in Article 2, it says that the President of the United States is to inform Congress of the State of the Union. So it's been a tradition since our first President, George Washington. The average length of the State of the Union message in American history is about 5,000 words. George Washington gave the shortest of them all, which was 833 words. Harry Truman gave the longest in 1946, which was 25,000 words. King Nebuchadnezzar's State of the Union is about 1,200 words of a man who encountered God. And what he writes about this episode in his life is monumental. Can you imagine a president of the United States on national television in front of Congress giving the State of the Union message? And he begins like this. He goes, "Distinguished members of Congress, citizens of the United States, and people of the world, God has spoken to me." One, I would like to see the president address the State of the Union like that. Imagine, you know, he says this, and then a silence would fall over the whole room. The White House staff would be scrambling of what to do next. Like, oh my gosh, what is he going to say? And all this havoc is going on behind the scenes. This is unusual, and it's unlikely. And then he would say something like, "God of heaven has gotten a hold of me and shown me his plan, not only for the world, but for my life." Now everybody's like, uh-oh, like what's going on? And essentially in chapter 4 of Daniel, that's what we have. And that's the State of the Union as seen by King Nebuchadnezzar after God has gotten hold of his life. So, and it's a remarkable section with a remarkable story. And he makes, it's a king who makes a remarkable statement. Okay, so now about 25-30 years has passed between chapter 3 and chapter 4. Overall, there's a gap of 16 years between chapter 2 and chapter 3, that it's been 45 years since the king received his first dream and interpretation from Daniel about the successive world governing empires. Okay, so someone reading this book or through the book of Daniel might say, doesn't this king cop a clue? Doesn't he, you know, can't he see or get the picture? And, you know, God has spoken to him dramatically in a dream in chapter 2. Chapter 3 was a miraculous deliverance of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego from the fiery furnace. Why isn't he not believing at this point? Why is this all necessary? Well, if you were to follow Nebuchadnezzar's journey so far, his spiritual journey, he was challenged, moved, and impressed by these episodes in chapter 2 and chapter 3. But you know what? Reading this situation and thinking about what's going on in your life, you can be challenged, but yet not change. You can be moved and yet not motivated. You can be impressed and yet not pressed to do anything about it. It's like being called an Alka-Seltzer Christian. You bubble up real quickly, but fizzle out just as quickly. And Nebuchadnezzar gets all excited in chapter 2 but he quickly forgets about it. In chapter 3, he'd forgotten the lessons that God was trying to get hold of him with. Up until now, King Nebuchadnezzar hasn't really been changed. And I say until now, remarkably, he is. In this remarkable story, a long one that we're actually cutting into two parts, chapter 4 we're going to look at this week, and then part of chapter 4 next week. The lessons we learn in these words ahead of us are simple. And it's simply that God can get hold of anyone and utterly change them, even a politician. And I know that's hard for some of you to believe, but it can happen. It also shows us our role and responsibility as believers to the authorities around us and the challenge that it will be for us to submit. So we're going to look at chapter 1 down to verse 8 from verse 1. I'm sorry, chapter 4 from verse 1 down to verse 18. A remarkable section, story, and a statement. Let's look at verses 1 through 3. And this is the opening of Nebuchadnezzar's decree. King Nebuchadnezzar, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. It has seemed good to me to show the signs and the wonders that the Most High God has done for me. How great are his signs, how mighty his wonders, his kingdom in an everlasting kingdom, and his dominion endures the generation from generation to generation. Okay, so the opening, Nebuchadnezzar the king. It's a unique chapter because this is a testimony of a Gentile king about how God changed his heart. We see the testimony of the last person you would ever think of that would be saved. We'll start to see the story of Nebuchadnezzar's conversion. And Nebuchadnezzar is a good example of witness who relates what is seen and experienced. It says here, I thought it good to declare. Okay? It's good to declare what God has done for us. Satan has a huge interest in keeping us unnaturally silent about the signs and the wonders that the Most High God has worked for us. And remarkably, and this in this remarkable and unique section, because it's the only portion of scripture written by a pagan king, or at least a one-time pagan king. It's in first person. I, me, my, this is what I saw. This is what I experienced. It's a king's personal account where he deals with the Most High God. The Gentile king is telling us what God has done in his life. God done something wonderful and he wanted to tell others. Did you know that this is the most basic way that the Christian message gets spread? One person shares what God has done for them to another. The work of God spreads. Since he was a king, he had a platform to share with others. It was a perfect opportunity for him to share. But look at what we have to understand. It says, his kingdom is an everlasting kingdom. Nebuchadnezzar recognizes God's kingdom is far greater and his dominion is unique because it's an everlasting kingdom. I'd say that any authentic contact with God must eventually be demonstrated in the life of a person who's made contact. And this is what we're seeing with King Nebuchadnezzar. What we have to see is that there's a God on the throne, and it's not us. And King Nebuchadnezzar had this confused. In the last chapter, he seemed to think that he was mightier than any god when he was casting people into the furnace. At the end of that chapter, his confidence was starting to be shaken. He began to understand that there is a God mightier than him. And it has to change you somehow. It has to humble you somehow. If you find a proud person who claims to know God, you have found a liar. When Isaiah the prophet encountered God, he said, "Woe is me, I am undone." When Peter understood that Jesus was who he understood him to be, he said, "Depart from me, Lord, I am a sinful man." He saw himself in the light of who Jesus was, and it changed him. It's like the old saying, if your religion hasn't changed you, maybe it's time for you to change your religion. And what we have here, what we have is King Nebuchadnezzar is changing his religion from the polytheism that he knew to believing in the true God. That's how I see it. This is his testimony, his personal encounter with God. And a few things are more powerful than your own verbal personal testimony of how God has worked in your life. And that is your spiritual journey. Have you ever let anyone you know or haven't seen in a long time know that you're Christian? You know, but hey, oh man, it's been 20 years. You know I'm Christian? And they're like, what? And you see a shocked expression. But then you have that one you least expect. You saw them, you had them in high school or whatever the case may be, and they're like, they're always picking, they were the bully, and it's like, oh man, this guy is going to be having trouble the rest of their life. But you have that one that you least expect that gives you a hug and says, me too. Thinking about this, right? Whether it was you or somebody else, somebody must have touched this guy. Is there someone that you consider hopeless or beyond reach that you wish were with you today? And you think, you know what? I don't think it would ever happen. Well, don't you think that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego might have thought that about King Nebuchadnezzar? Hebrews 7:25, it tells us he is able to save to the uttermost those who come to him by Christ. So, hey, regardless of where you're at in your journey, what you've done, come to Christ and you'll be amazed on what God sees in your heart and how you can be saved. So now we're about to see King Nebuchadnezzar came to writing his testimony. Let's look at verses 4-9. It says, "I, Nebuchadnezzar, was at ease in my house and prospering in my palace. I saw a dream that made me afraid. As I lay in bed, the fancies and the visions of my head alarmed me. So I made a decree that all wise men of Babylon should be brought before me, that they might make known to me the interpretation of the dream. Then the magicians, the enchanters, the Chaldeans, and the astrologers came in, and I told them the dream, but they could not make it known to me its interpretation. At last, Daniel came in before me, he who is named Belteshazzar, after the name of my God, and in whom is the spirit of the holy gods. And I told him the dream, saying, O Belteshazzar, chief of the magicians, because I know that the spirit of the holy gods is in you, and that no mystery is too difficult for you to tell me the visions of my dream that I saw and their interpretation." So here we kind of see only Daniel can explain the dream to Nebuchadnezzar. And we see, if you pay attention to this part, right? "Was at rest in my house and flourishing in my palace." King Nebuchadnezzar's rest was a false peace of the ungodly. God soon shook him from this false security. The most powerful ruler was at rest in the palace, but yet he was still troubled. King Nebuchadnezzar pretty much says, let me tell you a story. You know, when he's doing all this, right? He's not teaching directly and fundamentally a theological lesson. He's telling a story. So when he's telling his testimony, he's telling about something that happened to him. And this is one of the most powerful ways we communicate with the world today. You may say, hey, I'm not good with doctrine. I'm not good at reading scriptures or, you know, breaking it down verse by verse and so on, whatever the case may be. But guess what? There are more people who are reached with a story than they are through a theological lecture. Remember, some stories will have good endings, some will have bad, but here we are, drawn to this king. What happened to this king? In verse 5, we saw, no, he saw a dream and was afraid. Can't imagine that there was many things that make Nebuchadnezzar afraid, but this dream did. Now, we do realize that God can speak to us in dreams. However, we must be careful and not go around thinking that every dream you have is a message from God. That can be a very dangerous way to think. But let's see what comes next. Nebuchadnezzar is a very good storyteller. He's building it up. He says, I told them the dream, but they did not make it known to me its interpretation. Now remember, this is not the same dream from Daniel chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar readily told his counselors this dream, but they did not tell him what it meant. So reading through this, the dream was fairly easy to interpret. The wise men probably lacked the courage more than the insight. You know, Nebuchadnezzar says they did not make it known to me. He didn't say that they could not. So that means that these enchanters and all that, the wise men, they chose not to make it known. It's not that they couldn't. They chose not to. And it's not that they didn't understand the dream. They just didn't want to deliver the message to King Nebuchadnezzar. So he woke up and didn't know what to make of his dream. He knew it was significant, but couldn't piece it together. The message wasn't good news for Nebuchadnezzar. So that's probably another reason why they didn't want to share the news with King Nebuchadnezzar. But so we see a repeat from chapter 2, starting with the magicians. They didn't interpret the dream. So Daniel was called. Okay. So now you're thinking about this, right? They started with the magicians and all this whole series again, right? And then they called Daniel. Daniel after says, at last, Daniel came before me. Why at last? Why wasn't he sooner sent for? Why didn't they just go to Daniel first? You know, if the sorcerers could have served the turn, then Daniel would have never been sought for. This is a guise of graceless men. They run not to God until all other ways have failed them. Don't we do this? We try everything and nothing works. And then we go to God. Well, you know what? We should seek God first. It's better for us to make God our first resource instead of our last. His name is Belshazzar, according to the name of my God. Now listen to this part. According to the name of my God, okay? Before Daniel interpreted the dream for Nebuchadnezzar, the king considered the Babylonian deity Bel his god. What we're seeing here is that King Nebuchadnezzar still hasn't surrendered to God because he still refers to Bel his god. There's a huge difference between knowing about God then surrendering to God. To make this more clear, we can believe that Jesus is the Son of God, or we can believe in Jesus, the Son of God. Okay? That or in. Okay? Look at it this way. A man can believe that this woman would make a good wife, but when he marries her and invests in her, he puts his trust in this woman. Right? So there's a difference between believing a woman would make a good wife and putting the trust in the woman. So there's a difference. Nebuchadnezzar was in the place, but not in. He was in that place, but not in. Okay. Let's look at the history of Daniel and Nebuchadnezzar. Okay. Like believers living in a fishbowl, right? We're constantly being observed and evaluated by unbelievers. Nebuchadnezzar had watched Daniel for years in his kingdom. Okay. So I'm pretty sure Nebuchadnezzar seen that, hey, Daniel's a good guy. He acted a certain way and all that. And he's watched. He notices something. He notices that nothing rattles Daniel. Okay? No panic, no anxiety. Here's a man, Daniel, who lived with eyes upon God rather than circumstance. And unbelievers will notice that. This means that what he saw previously with Daniel and the three Hebrew young men was enough to impress him. My head, as I lay in bed, were these. I saw and behold a dream in the midst of the earth, and its height was great. The tree and grew and became strong, and its top reached to heaven, and it was visible to the end of the whole earth. Its leaves were beautiful and its fruit abundant, and in it was food for all. The beasts of the field found shade under it, and the birds of the heavens lived in its branches, and all flesh was fed from it. I saw in the visions of my head as I lay, and behold, a watcher, a holy one, came down from heaven. He proclaimed aloud and said thus, chop down the tree and lop off its branches. And scatter its fruit and the birds from its branches, but leave him with a band of iron and bronze. Let him be dew of heaven, let him from a man's, and let a beast's mind be given to him, and let 7 periods of time pass over him. The sentence is by the decree of the watchers, the decision by the word of the holy ones, to the end that the living may know that the Most High rules the kingdom of men and gives it to whom he will, and sets it over the lowest of men. Okay? So, the content of this dream, the rise and fall of a great tree, the tree in the midst of the earth. This tree in Nebuchadnezzar's dream was noted for its size, strength, prominence, beauty, fruit, and shelter. The tree so big that all the beasts of the earth was able to gather under it. What's the tree? It could be a kingdom. It could be a business. But it wasn't a kingdom, and it wasn't a business. Okay? And then we'll see here also, before we kind of understand what this tree is, he cried aloud and said thus, the watcher, okay? He's talking about the watcher, presumably an angel, explains the fate of this tree. You know why angels are called watchers? It's because they are watching us and not trying to make anyone uncomfortable, but we're under angelic observation right now. We're being watched. So make sure you're doing right because the angels are watching you. He notes that the tree is to be chopped down. It will lose its size, strength, prominence, beauty, fruit, and shelter. This magnificent tree extended into heaven. An angel descended and cut down to the stump. He also says that the tree represents a man who will be changed and given the heart of a beast. We see in verse 15, bound with a band of iron and bronze. These are either for the tree, stump, confinement, or protection. It's no longer for being free and great. And then he goes into verse 16. This is where we come and see, what does this tree represent? It's not a kingdom. It's not a business. This tree represents a man. And many love when God comes and knocks down someone who thinks that they're too big for their britches, right? You think somebody's so proud and all that, right? And then God comes down and knocks them down. And what do some people say? They're like, yeah, see, that's what you got, you know, whatever the case may be. But you know what? We can't think that way. You know, when someone's proud and they're digging a hole for someone to fall in, right? And what ends up happening? The person that dug the hole ends up falling into their own hole. What we tend not to like is when God does it to us. What we have to see is that God has to bring someone low in order for them to surrender. We can't come to God as equals saying, hey, you know what, God, I'm a really good cook, or I'm a really good woodwork. You know, let's get together in business and, you know, I'll do the wood and you do this. No, we're not equal. We have to come to God as rebellious creatures and submit. Okay. Do you want to be rebellious in a way to where God resists? Or do you want to be a humble person who God can give grace to? It says here, in order that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. Okay. Nebuchadnezzar heard these words in his dream. In light of this, the dream isn't hard to interpret. It clearly deals with the humbling of a great king. No wonder when none of Nebuchadnezzar's counselors wanted to interpret the dream for him. Like most kings, ancient and modern, Nebuchadnezzar wanted to believe that he ruled the world, or he ruled instead of God or anybody else. But the watcher from heaven comes down, and in this dream, he's calling all of the shots as Nebuchadnezzar is watching. Remember, remarkable section with a remarkable story, and the most remarkable is the statement. Keep in mind, Nebuchadnezzar is writing this to the whole world at the time. What Nebuchadnezzar's essentially saying is, hey, the purpose of this dream and what happened to me as a result of the dream, the purpose of all of that was for you to hear this. What he says is, first of all, God rules in human affairs. Or as he puts it, notice, the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. It's a key verse in chapter 4. It's a phrase mentioned 3 times in this chapter. The Most High God rules in the kingdom of men. We can't confuse with God being responsible for sin people commit. God permits the will of people to be executed within the restraints of parameters of his sovereign control. So those that say, why did God allow this? God's not responsible for this sin. Everybody has a choice. Everybody has free will. But it's within their strength of the parameters of God's sovereign control. God also overrules in political affairs. God has appointed a human government, and God has often allowed the worst people to rule. Pharaoh is not a great guy. Herod the Great is not a great guy. Nebuchadnezzar, he will admit it, not a great guy. This doesn't mean that God approves of all their actions, but he reserves the control of their appointment. And that's something we could think about today with what's happening in our government and our politics and our leaders and all that, right? Remember, God doesn't approve of their actions, but he controls their appointment for a reason. God's not saying they're a great person, but he has a purpose and he's going to reach them somehow. So don't get too excited if your guy or gal gets elected or not, because, hey, it says it here. He sets over them the lowest of men. Enough said. So, what does this mean to us Christians? It means that no matter what's the form of government, we have a responsibility to submit to human government, human authority. We're to be, of all people, model citizens. Why? Because we believe in what we just read. Jesus Christ stood before Pontius Pilate, an earthly ruler, Pontius Pilate, who was going to lower the gavel and sentence Jesus to death. And look at what Jesus says to him. You would have no power at all against me unless it had been given to you from above. God, my Father, has given you, Pontius Pilate, the authority to execute me for his eternal purpose of salvation as I go to the cross. Very powerful statement. Look at Romans, look in the book of Romans. It says Romans 13 on verse 1. Let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God. And those that exist have been instituted by God. Would that include your soul and my soul? I think every soul would sort of take care of that. There's no civil government that exists apart from the authority of God. So you say, but what about the cruel governments or unfair governments? You know what? God's in control. What's about to happen right now in this season? It ain't going to be great, but we got trust that God's in control. Look at when Paul wrote in Romans 13. You know who is in charge? Caesar Nero, the man who single-handedly killed thousands and millions of Christians by his policies. When David ran from King Saul, a government official who wanted to kill him rather than avenging him. David said in 1 Samuel 24, let the Lord judge between you and me. Let the Lord avenge me on you, but my hand shall not be against you. Wicked rulers are sometimes used by God to punish nations. God used Nebuchadnezzar to punish Judah, God's own people, according to Daniel chapter 1. And also, wicked rulers and wicked governments are sometimes used to purify God's people. So, with that, let us close with this. There are wicked rulers and wicked governments that persecute God's people. Us Christians. The early church flourished under the persecution of the Roman government. Okay. Now, in the 1940s, the government of China closed the doors to Western missionaries. They were ejected, pushed out. The government had to go underground because of the persecution. Many martyred because of their faith in Christ. It was illegal to be Christian. Illegal to have a Bible. And that is the case in many countries. The church went underground. And finally, when China began to open up again, we in the West were looking to see, are there any believers left? Only to discover there were now 50 to 100 million believers, all who had grown up under the worst, not best, government. All of that to say, a God-fearing government is ideal, but unnecessary for the effective spread of the gospel, right? Sometimes this bad situation is what, sometimes, you know, we don't listen, right? We never listen. So it gets to a point where God's going to allow a certain ruler, a certain leader, certain governor, mayor, president, whoever, to get people to start listening and turn to him. That might be the case today. We will see. But no matter how bad things get, the gospel will never be hindered. Never. Now, is there a time to violate the government and not submit? Yeah. Hold on to your seatbelt, because we will actually see more of that in Daniel chapter 16. And Daniel will do exactly that. We've already seen one instance of the last chapter when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did not bow down to the government authority. They stood their ground. In Acts 4, there's a legal edict to not preach the gospel or teach anymore in the name of Jesus Christ. And the apostles, what do they say? We must obey God rather than men. Whenever the government commands us to do what God forbids, or a government forbids us to do what God commands, we obey a higher law, and that is God's law. Our relationship to the government authority, human authority, is to what? Respect it, to submit to it, to support it with taxes, to pray for it, and occasionally to disobey it. But if, and only if, it violates God's law, That's the key point. We will disobey or when and if, only if it violates God's law. Because guess what? When it's time to go into that eternal kingdom, we ain't going to be going to our governor or mayor and asking for forgiveness or anything like that. No, we're going to get to those gates and we're going to be judged. And we have one person to answer to. Make that decision. So make sure you pray for the government. Even if you don't like your elected leader, you pray for them every single week. Every single week. Look at, I'm pretty sure Daniel was praying for Nebuchadnezzar. And look how many years later, we're still going through this.